have Peter Liu from Perimeter Institute. He's a postdoctoral researcher here. He did his PhD in San Diego, and he will tell us about topological quantum matter and quantum computation. So this is his first lecture. Peter, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Yep. Thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you for the organizers for inviting me to give this series of lectures. So hi everyone, I'm Peter and postdoc here. So So as the title implies, so I'm gonna talk about two different things. So the first one is about topological quantum matter, and the second thing is about quantum computing. So at the first glance, it looks like they are two very different things, right? Because typically when we consider the topological quantum matter, we have in mind that it is a research area belonging to the study of quantum matter, right? And what do people care about in the research area in quantum matter? So there, people are interested in when, say, you have many, many quantum particles, and when you put them all together, if you consider interaction between these particles, then what kind of collective behaviors can emerge due to the interaction between these two particles, right? Or in particular, people are interested in what kind of emergence order, some long-range order can emerge due to the interaction between these particles, right? So in particular, so let me just summarize study of quantum matter. So people care about the so-called emergence order. Right, and what kind of the possibility and all kinds of possible emergent order is what people are thinking about. Are there some exotic or interesting quantum order that is yet to be discovered? So that is a research frontier in quantum matter, right? And on the other hand, for the quantum computing, of course, it belongs to the research area of quantum information. So there, people are interested in very, very different questions. So in particular, so of course there are many different aspects, right? But one thing people care about is about how do you manipulate the quantum information given those quantum particles, right? And in particular, right nowadays, people care about how do we do quantum computing. So, you know, how to build a quantum computer is, you know, is a dream that people have been thinking about and have been, there has been lots of progress over these years. And there are many reasons behind this. For example, people believe that if you can build a quantum computer, then that is supposed to be much more powerful compared to the classical computer, right? And on the, and also at the same time, people believe that if you have a quantum computer, you can solve some, you know, very difficult questions that conventional computer cannot solve, right? So many, there are many reasons behind this. So as it turns out, there's an interesting connection between this emergent order given by those quantum matter and some powerful way to do the quantum computing. So there's a deep connection between these two. Yeah, and that will be the focus for this series of lectures. And so basically, and in particular for this emergent order, I'm gonna focus on the so-called topological quantum order. Yeah, so it turns out if you can realize a many-body system with this kind of topological order, then that may provide some, you know, very powerful and promising platform for realizing quantum computing in a very robust way, in the sense that because the difficulty in quantum computing is that, of course, you can have some qubits which encode some information, right? But the top part is those qubits try to, they were coupled to the environment, so there are some noise given by the environment. So how do we avoid those noise from the environment is a difficult task. As it turns out, if you can prepare topological order, then somehow the information will be robust under local noise from those environments. So there's a interesting interplay between topological quantum order and the quantum computing, right? So in these four lectures, I'm going to talk about some simple introduction about the connection between these two areas. And in addition, we're going to have a tutorial session, right? Followed by those four lectures. So the tutorial session will be a session where you'll have the opportunity to discuss some specific problems with me or with your classmate. And I have prepared the problem set. So please go to this, please use the following web address to access and to download those problem sets. Yeah, so just type in this web address in the, in your browser, and then you can access and download the problem set. So this is a short URL dot at followed by a slash line and followed by capital B, capital D, capital T, capital Y, and 2. Yeah. And you can find all the problems there. So I will encourage you to start to thinking about this the problem in the problem set right after the first lectures, because I think you need more time to think about so that during the tutorial session you know what to discuss and where is the confusion from, right? Yeah. All right, and this is my plan for the entire series of lectures. So I'm gonna begin from the so-called Turing code model, which is arguably the simplest toy model that can illustrate the notion of topological quantum order. And then after that, I'm gonna discuss this non-trivial quantum order from the aspects of symmetry. And there corresponding some interesting entanglement structure for those kind of states of matter. And afterwards, I'm gonna explain some basic notion about non-abelian topological order, which is more powerful compared to the abelian quantum order, like the Turing code. Non-abelian topological order. And finally, I'm gonna talk about some frontier research topic. Yeah, which include the so-called fracton topological order, which is more exotic quantum order compared to the conventional topological order states of matter. And I'm gonna talk about some states preparation, which is the one of the current interests, right? Because right now people have some access for qubits in the lab, right? So people want to build out some long-range entangled states of matter. So there are some recent progress about using some protocol to prepare this kind of long-range entangled state. So that's the subject about state preparation. And after that, I'm gonna talk about the stability of topological order at a non-zero temperature. And that is related to the so-called topological quantum memory at a non-zero temperature. So this is the syllabus and outline for the entire series of lectures. And feel free to ask questions if you have, if you have any. All right, so let me start from discussing this topological quantum order, which is some kind of exotic quantum state of matter. So there are several senses of being topological, and I want to summarize those features for you. Yeah, and these are the features you should keep in mind when we, when we go on for the class. So the first feature is that the number of ground states for the Hamiltonian you consider, that depends on the topology of the space. Yeah. So for example, if you consider, if you write down the Hamiltonian for describing the system you are of your interest, then as it turns out, whether you say, and you say you consider some 2D model, right? Say two space dimensional model, then as it turns out, if you consider the 2D on the surface of a sphere or the surface of a torus, then you get different number of ground states. So there's some interesting interplay between the number of ground states and the topology of the space manifold. So that is the first sense of being topological. And the second sense is there are some, if you consider this kind of topological order states of matter, you want to analyze the excitation of the systems. And as it turns out, the excitation, which people also call that to be some quasi-particles, and it turns out those quasi-particles, they are topological in the sense that a single excitation or a single quasi-particle cannot be created by some local operator. So that is the sense of being topological, and we'll see that later. And the third sense of is that you may want to use the idea of symmetry to classify or to understand topological order. And as it turns out, those symmetry are also kind of topological. Yeah, and in particular, so right now, there has been some general notion about the so-called generalized symmetry. And in particular, I'm gonna focus on the so-called higher form symmetry. And this kind of generalized symmetry provides some good way to understand certain topological quantum orders. And it turns out this symmetry is also topological, as you will see in this series of lectures. And finally, the entanglement structure is also topological. Yeah, in the sense that there are some long-range entanglements that cannot be destroyed by some local perturbation. So in that sense, there are some pattern of long-range entanglement, which is also topological, right? So these are the features you should keep in mind when we doing these lectures. And below, I'm going to tell you about the Z2 Torrey code, which is the simplest model to explain all these features of topological order. So yeah, let me just start. Right, so Z2 Torrey code model. So this is a model in two dimensional space. And it is a model proposed by Kitayev. Yeah, and it turns out this simple model, from this simple model, we can learn many different things about what's interesting about topological order. So to begin with, let me consider a 2D lattice. Yeah, and right now, basically, for every link or every edges for this 2D lattice, I'm gonna put a spin 1/2 particle. So for every link or every edge, you put a spin 1/2 particle. And spin 1/2 particle is also people call qubit, because there are two possible states, right? Yeah. And let me set up the stage for the notation I'm going to use. So when I write down, say, poly z, it is basically an unsized operator. And then it is just equal to the poly z operator, the conventional poly z operator. So it is diagonal in the spin up and spin down basis, like 1, 0, 0, minus 1, right? And I'm going to also introduce the poly x operator, which has some off-diagonal term. So 0, 0 in the diagonal, and 1, 1 here. Yeah, this is my notation. So I'm going to use this z and x to label the poly operators for every spins. And right now, let me introduce this the Hamiltonian that describes the interaction between different particles. Yeah, so basically there are two types of terms. So the first term is people call the star term. And the second term is people call the plaquette term. Right. So basically the star term live on vertices, and it is the product of four poly Zs around the vertices. So say there are many vertices, right, in this 2D lattice. So right now, just focus on some particular vertex. And of course, there are going to be four neighboring qubits surrounding this vertex, right? And this term is designed such that it is the product of four poly Z operators for those qubits. Yeah. And so the first term is you sum over all these possible local terms in the Hamiltonian, right, in the 2D lattice. And for the second term, the plaquette term, it is that you consider some particular plaquette labeled by P. And of course, there are going to be four qubits around the boundary of the plaquette, right? And you're going to design the interaction such that this BP term is the product of four poly X on those plaquettes, right? Yeah. So this defines the local term, and then you are going to sum over all those possible stars and the plaquettes, and that gives you the Hamiltonian for this model. Everything clear so far? And one feature that makes this model interesting is that it is exactly solvable. So this is the reason. So you find that all the star operator commutes, right? Because this is a part of four poly Z in some location, and this is a part of four poly Z in some other location, right? Labeled by S prime. And because they are all composed by poly Z operators, of course they commute trivially, right? And on the other hand, all the plaquette operators, they also commute with each other, right? Because the plaquette operator is the product of four poly X, and of course poly X commute with each other. But maybe a slightly non-trivial thing is, you notice that the commutator between any star operator and any plaquette operator is also equal to zero, right? So they commute. So of course, if you consider this lattice, right? So if you consider a star operator to be this guy, say S, so we get Z, 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 Z here. And if you consider another plaquette operator, say here, this is P, and you're gonna assign X, 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 X interaction, right? So of course, because the support don't overlap. So this guy will commute with this guy, right, trivially. But the non-trivial thing is that you can consider the neighboring, the star term and the placket term. So then you can draw something like this. Okay, so say there are four spins here. And you have Z, 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 Z from the star term, right? And if you consider neighboring parquet term, it is the product of, say you consider this parquet, right? So then the corresponding BP will be equal to the product of X, 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 X here. And as it turns out, as you can see here, they touch twice, right? One here and one here. So when they touch, that gives you a minus sign. But then they touch twice, so the minus sign will cancel to be a plus sign. So it turns out this operator will commute with this guy, right? So basically, this commutation relation is correct for any star operator and any parquet operator. So this is the reason that this is a solvable model, because if every operator in the Hamiltonian commute, then they share the same, you know, common eigenstate basis, right? So right now, people focus on, we can focus on the ground state of this Hamiltonian, right? Because that is the place where something interesting could happen. So because every term commute here, so when you talk about some ground state, right, you may as well just assign everything here to be one, right? The reason being, a local operator, the square of this local operator is equal to one, meaning the eigenspectrum of this operator is one and minus one. And you want to minimize the energy, right? So you may as well just assign those operators to have one in the expression value, right? And in this way, it turns out you can use this condition to solve for the grounds that you can have. So let me consider trying to write down some general ground states. Okay, so right now I'm gonna explain this ground state, which I don't know yet, in the product state basis. So this is the product state in the Z basis. So this specifies the configuration of the spin. So it is like a tensor product over every site. This guy is equal to this. So for every site, you can assign the spin to be up or down, and the entire configuration will give you this product state basis in the Z basis, right? Yeah. And this is a corresponding wave function, which we haven't determined yet. But now we're gonna show that using these two conditions, we can uniquely determine the ground state. Yeah, and let me just, to be pedantic, so for single SI, it can be one or minus one, which corresponding to spin up and spin down, right? All right, so let's focus on this, the first condition. That is that the star term in the ground state will be equal to one. So what does it mean? So for example, if you focus on a single star term in some vertices in the 2D lattice, right? Then what you find is that, okay, say you label this guy to be S1, S2, S3, S4, then the star term is equal to one, mean that for any configuration you can consider, the product of this guy must be equal to one. Right, because the star term is the product of four polyzs, then so in the if you expand that operator in the diagonal basis, the Pauli Z basis, then this is what you get, right? And what does it mean? It means that if you consider the possible configuration, so of course you can trivially set this guy to be 1, 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 right? And of course the product of the 1 will be equal to 1, so you satisfy this condition. But this is not the only possibility because for example, you can also choose the spin value for what to be minus 1 here, minus 1 here, minus 1 here, minus 1 here, right? So part of those value is also equal to 1, which satisfies this the star term condition. But again, this is not the only possibility because you may also consider you have an even number of spin down. So you have 1 here, 1 here, minus 1, minus 1 here, right? So the product of these values is also equal to 1 again. Yeah. So as it turns out, and in addition to this, there are also other configurations where there are 2 number of spin down and 2 number of spin up, right? And those are the order allowed configuration in the spin in the Hilbert space, right? So basically, the star terms give you a condition that the spin configuration must be form a loop. Let me try to erase this. All right, so let me recall. So S1, S2, S3, S4, the product of those guys is equal to 1. That means that there must be even number of spin down. Right? And a good way to understand it is that, say there's a link here. If it is a spin up, then you imagine you don't draw anything. The link is not occupied. On the other hand, sorry, this is like S equal to 1. On the other hand, if there's a qubit here, it is pointing down, then you give consider that link, you can draw some occupied wiggly line here. And this is a convenient way to understand the spin configuration, and this guy is S minus 1. So coming back to the allowed configuration here, so given this configuration, there's no occupied links. And here, you may as well draw this, right? And for this guy, you can draw this, because it is minus 1, and this is minus 1 in the Pauli Z basis. So basically, the even number of spin down condition means that you can only consider the loop configuration because the string cannot end, right? Let me erase this. So, for example, let me draw a lattice again. You ask, what are the product state spaces? What are the spin configuration that is consistent with this condition, even number of spin down? So it turns out you can only draw this kind of configuration, right? Right, if you draw this, that means that every spin along this red curve is equal to minus 1, which is spin down. And that is consistent with this condition, right? The star term is equal to 1 because for every star term here, there must be even number of spin down, right? So that means this red link cannot end. So it must form some closed loop. And those closed loop condition will satisfy this AS to be 1 condition, the star term to be 1. And of course, you can consider many loops at the same time, right? So for example, you can also consider this kind of configuration in the Hilbert space, right? So basically, the first condition tells you that there are only certain configuration you can consider. So so when you write down this wave function, you may as well write that in the loop configuration basis. So by that, I mean, originally, you sum over all the possible polar state bases, right? You may as well just write per psi to be, you sum over all the closed loop, and you assign a wave function for the loop configuration, and you label by C, which is some particular loop configuration, right? So right now, you simplify the wave function a little bit. So right now, let's consider what is the condition BP to be one tell us. So as it turns out, this star term introduced some constraint in the Hilbert space, and this BP introduced some quantum fluctuation for the wave function. So for that, let's try to understand what is the action given by P. All right, so basically, because the expression value for BP operator is equal to one, right? So that means you're gonna find a wave function such that BP at on the ground state will give you the same ground state, right? That is the way to get the expression value to be one. So basically, what you find is that, for example, if you act on a configuration where there's no loop, that means every spin is pointing up, right? So if you consider this guy, because this is in the poly Z basis, and this is in the poly X basis, so that means you are gonna flip the spin around this packet, right? So that means you're gonna consider some particular packet here, and you create a loop like this. You create a contractible loop, right? Because this is a product of poly X, and when poly X operator adds on the spin, you just flip the sign for the spin, right? And on the other hand, this is a Z2 operator, so that means if you start from some configuration where it is already occupied, there's a link, there's a loop here, right? And when this operator adds on this configuration, then you annihilate that loop. So you bring to the configuration where there's no loop, right? This is the action given by those packet operators. And maybe a slightly non-trivial thing is if you consider a configuration where this is already a loop here, that is the neighboring to this packet. So when this guy adds on this polar state basis, you're gonna flip the spin here, and spin here, spin here, spin here, right? So that means you deform the loop. You get a bigger loop like this, right? Yeah. So BP operator basically involves the quantum fluctuation and the transition between different polar state spaces. And right now, let's try to write down the ground state. So as it turns out, because the BP will involve the transition between different polar states, right? So if you say that, okay, if this transition operator acts on the ground state, it will give you the same ground state. That means every possible wave function must have the equal value, right? That is, the ground state wave function should be all the possible loop with the equal weight, right? Why is that? Because when you act on the BP operator here, then for this guy, the product state configuration just modified by the boundary of this packet operator. So you map to a different ground state. So you map to a different loop configuration, right? Yeah. So when you add some BP operator, you introduce some transition between the product state. But only when you assign the value to be one, the weight to be one, then the state can be invariant under this operator, right? So this is the ground state we just found. This is the ground state for the Turing code model. And probably a quicker way is you notice that this is equivalent to this. Why is that? All right, so say you start from the product state basis, every spin is pointing up, so there's no loop, right? And then you project the product state with this projector, right? So this is a projector. Only when BP equal to one, then you select, you get some non-zero number, so it is a projector. And the square for this guy is equal to one. Then why this is a ground state? So basically, when you consider the star operator acting on this ground state, right? Because the star operator will commit with this BP operator. So AS just carry over to acting on the product state. And of course, there's no loop in the product state basis, so AS is equal to one, right? And on the other hand, if you consider BP acting on this ground state, now what you find is that there cannot be some particular BP. So you plot over all the possible parquet, right? And there's a particular parquet specified by this operator. But because the BP acts on 1 plus BP is still equal to 1 plus BP, right? Because BP square to 1. So by writing down this kind of expression, you notice that it is also invariant under the action given by the BP operator, right? So this is one way to write down ground state. And if you try to expand this guy, you recover this ground state you have, right? Why is that? Because you're gonna consider the product of this 1 plus BP over 2, right? And so for each term, you can either choose 1 or BP. Whenever you choose BP, you create some corresponding loop configuration. So if you consider all the possible products, then you do the expansion, then this is what you get, right? You get a sum of all the possible contractible loop configuration. Yeah, so this might be a quicker way to memorize how do you write out ground state. So as it turns out, so this is the ground state for the Turing code model. So as you can see here, because the number of possible loops in the Hilbert space scale exponentially with the system size, so it is a massive quantum superposition of loops. And that is why the state is kind of interesting, as we will see later. So right now we see that even for this ground state, by writing down this ground state wave function, there are already two sets of being topological, which is kind of fun. So yeah, the first thing is that you have a constrained Hilbert space. When you consider the star operator to be one, you can only consider the loop configuration in the product state basis, right? So only loops are allowed. And the second sense of being topological is that the wave function is kind of topological. Right? So if you can try to understand the wave function for a given loop configuration, right? And it turns out the wave function is equal when you can smoothly deform those loops, right? So in that sense, the wave function is also topological. And right now we're gonna see that there's a third sense of being topological, that is the ground state degeneracy, which is maybe the most interesting part. And maybe let me also mention that When you write down this ground state wave function, you find that, you know, typically when people want to understand whether there's an order or not, right, people consider the two-point function. Say, you can consider this zi, zj, right? Then say, if it is some order one number, then we say there's some interesting long-range order for the state. But as it turns out, when you write down this wave function, it's a simple task to check that this guy is actually equal to zero. So if you consider some, you know, some two-point function, for example, to want to detect the long-range order for the state, you're gonna find zero. So at the first glance, you may think, okay, the state's pretty trivial. There are nothing interesting there. But as it turns out, there are some hidden long-range order that cannot be detected by some local operator. So that's why there are something we call topological order going on for the ground state wave function. Yeah, so roughly speaking, the intuition is that this order is kind of non-local, so it cannot be detected by local operators, so it is topological. Okay, so right now let's consider put a Torrey code on a lattice. On a torus. So by that, you can imagine when I draw the 2D lattice, you can consider the periodic boundary condition here and here. So these two edges are identified to be the same here, meaning we consider the periodic boundary condition in this direction and also this direction. So these edges is identified as the edges in the below. And what that means is that when you're trying to plot the topology of this space manifold, you get a torus, right? Because say, for example, you have a line that span around the entire vertical axis, right? Then because this is in the periodic boundary condition, so when you draw a blue line in this lattice, you will recover this kind of line, right? Which is non-contractible, right? And similarly, you can also draw a line vertically, spanning around the entire 2D lattice, and what you find is that this line corresponding to line around this torus, right, in this vertical direction. Yeah. So when you consider the PBC for the 2D lattice you recover, you know that the manifold is a torus. And right now, let's try to do a simple calculation to check whether this is a unique ground state for the Torrey code. So it turns out it is not. It turns out the number of ground state depends on the topology of the space manifold. And this can be seen from some simple counting arguments. So the question is, when you write down this Hamiltonian on a torus, how many ground state you have? Okay, so because we know that the number of spin is 2L squared, right? So you consider the L by L lattice size, and because for each vertices, you can associate two link, right? And there are L number of vertices, and for each vertices, there are two associated link, so the number of qubits is 2L squared. So the total Hilbert space dimension is 2 to the 2L squared, right? Because qubit is like a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So entire Hilbert space is 2 to the 2L squared. And right now you can ask, okay, when I specify, because I want to know the dimension for the ground subspace, right? And that subspace is specified by condition that these two operators will be equal to 1, right? So that means you know some information about the ground state subspace, right? Because for example, if I know nothing, of course the entire Hilbert space is 2 to the 2L squared. But if I specify the subspace where the A as must be equal to 1. That means I can reduct, I can subdivide it by, divide it by 2, right, to get a subspace where the AS is equal to 1. So you just need to count what is the number of constraints in the Hilbert space, and that can give you the ground state's dimension, right? Yeah. Where this number is the number of constraints specified by these operators. Right, so let's just count how many number of star term and parquet term there, then we can know this number, right? So for the star term, of course, number of the star term is equal to L squared, because there are L squared number of vertices, right? But on the other hand, you know they are not independent from each other because the product of star operator is equal to 1, right? Because when you draw a 2D lattice, if you select, and when you try to write down this, right? So for every star, you associate it with 4 poly Z operators. But if you also select this guy, if you select everything, then it is that you apply nothing, right, in the Hilbert space. And this happens if you consider the torus in the periodic boundary condition. But so you should be careful here. We should only consider the number of independent star operator. And this guy is equal to L squared minus 1.
Peter.
Yeah.
So to count the number of ground states, shouldn't we like subtract the number of constraints instead of dividing by 2 to the, this feels like every constraint is removing 2 degrees of freedom or something.
Oh, you mean here I should write down the minus 2 to the number here?
Yeah, I mean, how are we counting
the ground states? Yeah. All right, so let's try to do some simple counting, say, say H is the total Hilbert space dimension, right? And I want to ask, what is the subspace where the O operator is equal to 1? So operator can take two possible values, right? It's a Z2 operator, basically. And I ask a question, that is, what is the dimension for the subspace where O is equal to 1? Mm-hmm. Then the answer is this guy divided by 2, right?
Yeah.
And if I know more, then I just divide it by 2 to the 2, right? Yeah. So this number counts the number of knowledge you have, the number of independent operator you have. So you need to divide it by that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good question. Right. But the reason why we need to care about the number of independent operator is because, say, you have O1 here, you have O2 here. So initially, you may say, okay, there are 3 operators, so you should count 2 to the 3, right? But if I consider a condition where this O3 is nothing but the product of O1 and O2, then this is not independent stabilized operator, so you should just subtract it by 2 to the 2. Yeah, because when you specify the knowledge for O3, you are getting nothing, right? So that is the reason why you should care about the number of independent operators to count the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay, and right now we can do the similar calculation for the parquet operators. So of course, it's a latent with L by L, right? So number per capita is L squared as well. But again, the product of all the per capita operator is equal to 1. So the number of independent operator is L squared minus 1. And in particular, this only happens if you consider two torus, right? I mean, in a periodic boundary condition. So right now we have this information. So let's just try to write down. So this guy will be equal to 2 to 2 L squared subtracted by L squared minus 1 independent star operator, and then you subtract it by L squared minus 1, the number of independent bracket operator. And you find that, so L squared probably just go away, and you find 2 to 2, so it is 4. So it tells you that this simple calculation, you can see that there are 4 ground state degeneracy given this Hamiltonian. And it only happens if you consider this kind of periodic boundary condition, right? And if you consider more different topology, you can do different counting and you get different number of ground state. Yeah. But let me just proceed.
So Peter, so the periodic boundary conditions is giving us that one constraint of product equals 1.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's right. All right, so let's try to write down all the possible ground states and to see what is the implication about relation to quantum computing. All right, so clearly, as our calculation before, we know that we can write down one of the ground states to be this guy. Sorry, let me label by the ground state by 0, 0 with a reason that we'll know very, very soon. So as you mentioned before, you can write down the ground state to be this guy, right? The product of basically the projector acting on the product state where every spin is pointing up. And if you do the expansion for this projector, you recover that it is the sum of all the possible contractible loop. Right. The reason being, if you consider the product of parquet operators, then it must be the boundary of some parquet, so it is contractible. Right? So this is one ground state we already found before. Then let's try to understand what are the remaining three different ground states. So as it turns out, the ground state, different ground states are distinguished by their winding number around the x-axis and the y-axis. So to see those ground states, let me define a loop operator that winds around the entire torus. All right, so let me consider the operator, say Wx, and that is equal to the product of x on the link spanning around this x horizontal axis. Yeah, so on a torus, this operator is basically this operator, the product of x around this direction, right? Let me define that. And similarly, I can also define an operator that winds around the y-axis. Say x, 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 x. Yeah. Okay, so it turns out, starting from this ground state, and then you apply this operator, you can create a different ground state. And to see that, let me introduce a ground state, and this is just a notation with a reason you will see later, 1, 0. You consider this a loop operator acting on one of the ground states which we already have, which is this guy. Okay, so this is the expression for the ground state. So let's first check whether it satisfies the condition that AS and BP to be one for this ground state. Okay, so of course, you may want to consider, say, the BP operator. Yeah, let me just say in words. Given this ground state, if you activate by the BP operator, what you find is that this is a part of X, and the BP operator is also a part of X, so they commute. So when you activate by the BP operator, it just carry over through here, right? And the BP operator will take the product with this guy, and it is that you are adding nothing, right? Because BP times 1 plus BP is equal to 1 plus BP as well, it's a projector. So of course, if you write down this ground state, it satisfies this condition. But what about AS operator? If you consider AS acting on this ground state, what you find is that this guy, they commute actually. The reason being, AS is a part of 4 poly Z, right? And as you can see here, if you consider a star term here, then you appear that this is Z, 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 Z. So they overlap twice, right? So that's why they commute. So you may just exchange these two positions. One plus BP, acting on all the spin up state. And as we know before, the star term will commute with this packet operator. So you just carry over through, right? And AS acting on the or every spin up state, then you got one. So if you write down this ground state, if you write down this state, it is a ground state because it satisfies these two conditions by applying the non-contractible loop operators, right? And more specifically, it is a sum of all the possible loops. But right now, this every loop configuration will have a non-zero winding number around the x-axis. So pictorially, how should we visualize those loop configuration? So for example, when you draw a 2D lattice, you can imagine you have this kind of loop, right? The non-contractile loop given by the part of X around this one direction of the torus. And on the other hand, this loop is also deformable. You may as well consider this. Right. This is also allowed possible loop configuration. And similarly, you can also consider this guy, the other loop as well. And you're gonna superpose all those possible allowed loop configuration where there's a odd number of winding number around that axis, right? Which is given by the part of X, right? And similarly, you can also, starting from this ground state, the 0, 0, you can also activate by this operate the part of X around another direction, right? And that gives you another different ground state. So finally, you work out all the possible ground state, right? There are only 4 ground states. So ground state can be labeled by say A and B. Where A and B, they can be either 0 or 1, right? So different A and B corresponding to whether you want to apply, you know, a non-contractile loop around one direction or not. And for each direction, there are 2 choices. So you get 4 possible ground state.
Peter, sorry, a quick point. On the second tunnel of the board, towards the bottom.
Here?
No, left, a bit lower. Yeah, there.
Yeah.
After 1 plus BP, could it be up, up, or 0, 0? The states, the cats.
This is one possible ground state. And then, oh, sorry. Oh, right. Yeah, thank you.
Was actually someone online who.
Oh, right. Right. Yeah, thank you for catching that. Yeah. This is one particular ground state. And this is given by stuff on the product state acted by the projector. So, yeah, so you get this. Yeah. And given this ground state, by applying this loop operator around one direction, you can create a different ground state. Yeah. Thank you. All right, so you work out that, you realize that, okay, you recover these four possible ground states, and indeed, they are orthogonal to each other, right? Because, for example, the support, they are different. Different ground states, they are labeled by, you know, whether you can consider, different grounds, they are labeled by the topology of the loop they consider, right? So indeed, they are orthogonal. And one feature, so there are a few features. So they are locally indistinguishable. So by that, I mean, if you consider any possible ground states, so A and B can be either 0 or 1, so you have four choices. You can, if you sandwich with a local operator, say, oh, it is a product of, I don't know, any operator in some order one region, right? Then you find that this is simply equal to this. So in other words, the expectation value of a local operator doesn't depend on which ground state you are using, right? Which makes sense because different grounds, they are only different because the global 1D number, and the local operator cannot tell this global property of the states, right? So they cannot tell which grounds that you are in. So they all take the same value locally. Or in other words, you may as well try to write out the reduced density matrix supported on a subregion. So this is a 2D space. This is A, and it's divided into A and A bar. This is a 2D surface. You may want to compute the reduced density matrix for local region A by tracing out A bar. Then you'll find that this doesn't depend on which ground state you are using. Yeah. And because the reduced density matrix encodes all the local data for that region, so, and because of this condition, so you cannot tell the difference between different ground states. All right, so in order to, how do we tell the different ground states? So it turns out you need to consider some non-local operator, then you can distinguish between different ground states. For example, we may consider the product of poly z's like this, around one direction, and let me call that to be vx. Or we can also consider the product of z in the vertical direction, winding around the torus. Let me call that to be vy. So as it turns out, so here is the four possible ground states of the torus code, right? And if I consider 0, 0, which was one of the ground states, then you find that the corresponding operator value is equal to you get Vx to be Vy is equal to 0. By this, I mean that given this operator you sandwich with the corresponding ground state, then you get 1. Yeah. So you find this relation, basically. So basically, when you consider the plot of poly Z around this direction, you detect whether vertically there's a non-zero one-D number or not. So that is the reason why this operator can tell the difference between different ground states. And also, let me mention that it's kind of interesting to put this the plot of Z and the plot of S together for comparison. So basically, the idea is that you notice this operator realizes the algebra of, I mean, the Pauli algebra for when you consider two qubit, right? So schematically, when you write out Wx is the product of x, right? And let me call that to be x1 bar. And similarly for Wy, it is the x around the vertical direction. And let me call that to be x2 bar. And similarly, I can consider the plot of z's around at the x direction. It's the plot of z's. I can call this to be z2 bar. And the plot of z around the y direction, I call that to be z1 bar. Then what you find is that x1 bar, z1 bar, is equal to minus z1 bar, x1 bar. And similarly, x2 bar, z2 bar is equal to minus z2 bar, x1 bar. So you're basically using this non-local operator to realize the algebra for two qubits, which makes sense. And this suggests that in a ground state subspace, this four-dimensional Hilbert space, you can encode two qubits. And once you encode these two qubits, the information can be robust under some local noise. And what is the reason? So that is what we call the topological quantum memory, because you can use this algebra of the string operator to encode some useful information in the ground subspace. So roughly speaking, the idea is this. If you have two qubits, right, and you may write them right now, okay, psi for two qubits is equal to, I don't know, alpha 0,0 plus beta 0,1 plus gamma 1,0 plus delta 1,1, right? Okay, so if in the experiment or in the lab, if you only have two qubits, and this is the generic wave function for that two qubit, right? So as it turns out, this is very fragile, right? Because if you apply some local operator, either acting on the first qubit or the second qubit, you can do something non-trivial for the wave, for the information you encode, right? By that information, I mean alpha, beta, gamma, delta. But right now, if you try to encode this wave function in the ground subspace of the Turing code, then that is much more robust. So this is called encoding. You want to encode the information of two qubits into the many-body Hilbert space, but in the ground state of the Turing code, and that is called encoding. So yeah, you can just promote the state to be like alpha 0,0. Yeah, I'm gonna write down the same thing, but right now when you do the encoding, this turned out to be some many-body state, right? It is a ground state of the Turing code. And as we just seen, you need to apply some non-local operator, then you can do something non-trivial for the ground state subspace. So if you do the encoding, then this is a many-body state. So it is more robust. So a local noise will not do anything for the Turing code. So that's why it is a good quantum memory. Yeah.
So Peter, that the algebra is realized only in the ground states.
In the ground states, yeah. Ground. Oh, sorry. Yeah, when I define this operator, this is correct. It doesn't depend on whether you are in the ground state or not.
Oh, okay.
But this is the operator you use to encode the information and try to manipulate the information in the ground subspace.
Okay.
Yeah. But this is correct for, yeah, for in the Hilbert space as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, So by when you say that these will be the operators that will be used to manipulate the in the encoded space, you mean they will act like poly operators or something in that space?
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's see. Yeah, so I want to mention that, so this define a notion of a robust topological quantum memory. Yeah, so basically, you may try to imagine you can perturb the Turing code Hamiltonian, right? By some, you know, on-site term. Yeah. So of course, you may try to imagine you're gonna get a one-dimensional phase diagram. So here is G is equal to infinity, and in this point, of course, this term will dominate. So the state is unique, and it can only point into the spin up, which is a trivial state. And if you consider G to be zero, you recover the torical limit. And there are some topological order here. So when you turn the G, you find that when you turn on a little bit very small G, you cannot lift the ground state degeneracy. So basically, there's gonna be some quantum critical point separating these two phases. So this is one phase, and this is another phase. This is the trivial phase, and this is the topological order phase. So here, there are some integer label, for example. In this phase, throughout this region of the phase diagram, the number of ground state is equal to 4. Meaning that if you add some local perturbation, right, you are not destroying the topological degeneracy, so that is robust. And here, it is a trivial state. So the number of ground state is only equal to 1. So you see that the number of ground state is an integer label. So you cannot continuously deform to an integer label, right? So that means that basically you are gonna, when you turn this G, you're gonna incur some quantum critical transition so that you can completely destroy the encoded information here. And more specifically, you can try to do the degenerate perturbation theory to try to understand the lifting for the ground state degeneracy, right? So basically, in the formalism for degenerate perturbation theory, you ask, what is the order of the perturbation you need to go in order to connect different ground states, right? But as it turns out, as we just discussed, you need to apply some non-local, you know, very long string operator to connect different ground states. So that means the tunneling amplitude between different ground states is very small. Yeah, so this is in the framework of the degenerate perturbation theory. You ask, how can you lift the ground state degeneracy? So you ask, what is the tunneling probability between different ground states? And because this is an on-site perturbation, right? And in order to tell the different, in order to consider the tunneling between different ground states, you need to consider this kind of product of Z around one direction, right? So that means the amplitude is basically like G to the L, right? You need to go to L order of the perturbation theory so that you can distinguish between different ground states, you can connect different ground states. So basically, when G is very small, yeah, this guy will decay exponentially, right? So that means there's some robustness due to the fact that only non-local operator can distinguish and can act non-trivially for the ground state subspace, right? So that local perturbation will not destroy the degeneracy. Yeah. So this degeneracy is also robust. Yeah. And more generally, you may consider, in addition to adding this term, you can also allow to add this kind of term. And the conclusion will be the same, right? Because you really need to go to else order perturbation theory to connect different ground states. So it doesn't matter what is the functional form for the local operator you act. So that is a robust property for this state of matter. Yeah. Okay, so in the remaining Yeah. Mm-hmm. Aldo, do you think when we should, when, yeah. Okay, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Sounds good. And let me also mention that, as we see here, using different string operator, you can create different grounds there, right? So if you consider some topology where, okay, so here we consider some torus, the genus is one. If you consider more some torus where there are two genus and there are two holes, right? There are more kinds of non-contractable loop. So that means you have more degrees of freedom to create different ground states. So you can see that the ground state degeneracy will depend on the topology of the space manifold. Yeah. All right, so right now let me try to understand some interesting properties for the Turi code by analyzing the excitations. So as it turns out, it supports some interesting particle that is called anions. And the statistics are very different from the conventional fermions or boson. Yeah. All right, so just a brief history review. So boson, the idea of the boson is proposed by, you know, Bose and Einstein in 1924. Yeah. And the idea of fermions is basically 1925, we have Pauli, so there's a Pauli exclusion principle. Yeah, saying that two fermions can occupy the same state. And more specifically, we have the idea of the Fermi-Dirac distribution, right, after Pauli. But there's some interesting story behind this. So Fermi-Dirac distribution is actually first discovered by Jordan. It's not by Fermi or Dirac, it's first discovered by Jordan, 1925. And so actually Jordan first discovered this distribution, and Fermi-Dirac is actually not, 1926. Yeah, but right now we name this distribution to be Fermi-Dirac distribution because there's some interesting story behind this. So we don't name Jordan distribution. Yeah. You may want to find out the story behind this. And so there's a large gap in the years. So only until 1977, people realized that these two people, these two people realized that if you consider the two space dimension, you could have some, in general, in principle, you could have some statistics that are neither fermionic or bosonic, and that can happen for 2D. But in 3D, when you have two planar particles, say the position is labeled by R1, R2 in 3D, then when you do exchange, right, you can only get a plus or minus one sign. And the reason being, if you exchange twice, you are doing nothing in 3D. So you need to go back to itself so it can only allow the Z2 value plus or minus one sign. Yeah, but in 2D, the story is very, very different. Because in 2D, when you exchange the particle twice, you do something non-trivially in the space-time picture. So it is useful to draw some space-time picture. So in 2D, the two exchanges is not equal to identity operation. And this can be seen from this following picture. So to say this is time and this is space. So initially you have two particles here, point-like particles, one here and one here. When you do the exchange, right, you may imagine the world line of these particles will feel like this, right? Yeah, so this is the first exchange. And then if you do the exchange again, this is something you get, right? And and you can see that there are some interesting braiding between these two particles. So one way to see that is that you can imagine right, you follow the trajectory for the first particle, and you can enclose in the space-time trajectory. And you can do the same for the other particles. So you can see here, you create a knot in the space-time, and this is different from this, right? If you do nothing, this is the space-time picture you should have. The particle, there's no interesting braiding between these two particles. But if you consider in 2D, and then if you exchange twice, you create a knot in the space-time. So that is the reason why it doesn't need to be identity operation. So when you do the braiding twice, you don't necessarily need to get the boson or fermions. So that's why you can support anyon in principle. Yeah. So right now, let me use maybe 10 or 15 minutes to explain the idea of the anyon for the context for the 2D Turing code. So the first thing you can do is that you can analyze the excitation of this this term. So that means that you're gonna violate, you're gonna create some, you're gonna apply some operator in the ground state. And when you apply that operator, you're gonna have some excitations that violate the condition that this operator is one. So specifically, say when you apply the product of x operator, given starting from the ground state, then what do you have? Say I consider this operator at one of the ground states. Yeah, it doesn't matter which ground state you are in so far, in this moment. So basically, when you consider this kind of state, you apply some local operator at the ground state, then you find that when you apply this operator, you create two excitations on the boundary of these operators. So that means if you evaluate, say, the star term with respect to this perturbed state, you are gonna find that the value will be equal to minus one. So locally, there are energy excitation given by this particle. And the reason to see it is that you have a x operator here, right? And this x operator will anti-commute with the star term right, because right here, right? Because they touch once. So you flip the sign for the star operator. And similarly, you create another excitation here. Right? The AS is equal to minus one here. And every other thing will be the same, right? You only, when you apply some string operator, you only create two excitations on the boundary of the operator, right? And more schematically, you can imagine you can also apply some operator here, 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 then you can move this particle from here to here, right? Yeah. So the excitation is only supported by on the boundary of the string operator. So schematically, you have a deformable line operator, the product of poly x, for example, and then you create only two excitations here. So roughly speaking, you can imagine it doesn't matter how many operator I apply, right? So when I extend the string, the length of the string, I didn't create more excitations. So I can extend, I can separate these two particles arbitrarily far away from each other without costing extra energy, right? So in that sense, people call that it is a deconfined particle. Because once you create these particles, it doesn't cost you any extra energy to move these particles. And in particular, if you consider, if you in some region, you find that, okay, there's a excitation here, then you find that if you have a, in some region, if you move these two particles away from each other, then in a local region, this excitation cannot be created by local operators, right? Because you need to imagine there's a very long string operator that connect this guy to a very far away from each other, then there's another particle there, right? So in other words, people often say that this is a, this excitation is topological because it cannot be created by local operators. Yeah, you can imagine there are secrets, there are some connected by some topological string, right? Yeah, and similarly, let me analyze a different excitations by applying some poly Z operators on a ground state.
Peter, why do you say that they don't? There's no extra energy cost?
Oh, right. Yeah. Because okay, so say I apply XX here, mm-hmm. I create two excitations here, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it violates these two terms, and then I can apply X operator here. Then right now, because the star term commute with this guy, because they touch it twice, so you basically just move this particle from here to here. So you can imagine you can separate this particle without costing any energy, right? Yeah, so that's the, yeah, that's it. All right, and right now let me try to analyze the different excitations that come from the Parquet term. Right. So you can imagine I apply the poly Z in this pattern, right? So yeah, let me just consider these poly Zs. So when I apply this poly Z operator, it intercommutes with the Parquet term here and here, right? And the thing in the middle, they commute because they touch twice. It's a product of X, 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 X. So let's commute with this two poly Z, so it doesn't do anything for that Parquet operator. But you create two excitations here. Here will be BP to be minus one. And here, you will also get BP to be minus one. So you create two local excitations. And let me also say that for this excitation on the vertices, people typically call that to be the E particle. And for this kind of excitations, people call that to be the M particle or magnetic flux. Yeah, and again, you can imagine you can separate these two particles without costing extra energy, right? For example, you can just apply Z, Z, Z here. Then you can move this excitation, you can move this particle from here to here, right? So the physics is the same. Yeah, but it's just that this particle, this excitation live on the vertices, and the Parquet operator will associate with this M particle and live on the Parquet. And right now, let's see that the gradient structure of these particles, and that is what something interesting can happen. So the first thing is that, say you have a particle here, say E particle here and E particle here. You can imagine you can also have an E particle here, E particle here. So you can imagine you can apply some unitary operator that try to braid this guy around, right? And then come back to itself. And that completes a braiding. And because the this E particle is supported by the product of poly X. So when you try to drag this particle around this guy, you don't get it, you don't get any sign, right? So that's why we code the E particle itself is a self boson. Because when you drag it, when you brag this E particle together, you don't get any non-trivial sign. And similarly, for the M particle, it is also self boson. Because M particle are all supported by the same species of the Pauli operator, right? So when you brag them around, then you don't get minus sign. But what interesting thing is the braiding between E particle and M particle, there is something called a semionic statistics.
Peter, can you explain what you mean by braiding?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So you can, starting from the ground state, you can imagine there's a product of poly X. Right. When you apply this string operator, you create two excitations here. Similarly, you can imagine you can apply the product of poly X to create these two excitations. So right now, when I want to say that I want to simulate the braiding between two particles, I imagine I apply, given this particle, I'm gonna move it around. And the way to move it around is I apply a bunch of poly X operator, right? So I can drag this guy around this, and then I'm gonna come back. But along this curve is the product of poly X. But when I do this, this is a unitary process, simulate the process of the braiding. And as you can see here, because they're all composed by product of poly X, so that's why they commute, there's no minus sign. But right now, the situation will be different if you consider the braiding between E particles and M particle. All right, so say, starting from the ground state, you do some operators acting on the ground state. So say you create an excitation here, the M particles. So this is M particle, and the corresponding operator value is equal to minus one, right? So you imagine there's a situation like this. And imagine there's another E particle here. Right? Okay, so say this is the given situation. How do I simulate the braiding between these two? So one thing I can do is, because E particle is given by, is supported by the product of poly X, right? So when I can, one thing I can do is that I apply the product of poly X right? When I apply the, given that given state, when I apply the product of poly X acting on that state, then this simulates the process of the braiding, right? Because then you move this guy around, you move this E particle around this M particle, and what you find is that you pick out a minus sign, that is, say the unitary operator is given by the product of poly X, right? The product of poly X is this loop, right? This is a unitary operator that you use to do the braiding between these two particles. So basically what you find is that U operator acts on whatever original state you have. You pick out a minus sign, which is non-trivial. And the reason being that when you consider the product of poly X around this guy, right? It may be as well be written as the product of poly, the product of parquet operator. In this region, right? Because the product of poly X on the boundary can be equal to the product of every single parquet operator enclosed by the loop, right? Yeah. So, and the reason why you get a minus sign is because this guy is simply the product of parquet operators in that region. And because you know that there's a magnetic particle here, the BP is equal to minus one. So the product of this parquet operator is gonna be equal to minus one. Yeah, so that's why you get a minus one sign, right? And people call that to be, this minus one is the semionic statistics. And why that is interesting? Because when you imagine, when you do this braiding process, right? Right now, initially, M particle is here, E particle is here. If you do this braiding, eventually, they come back to the original position, right? So it is that you exchange their position twice. And if you exchange position twice, you get a minus sign. And that cannot happen for either fermion or boson, right? Because for those particles, when you exchange twice, you're gonna get the plus one sign. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm pretty much done with the discussion for these anion excitations. So those are the interesting particles that can happen in 2D. And let me just summarize by saying that the Z2 topological order we just described is associated with, typically people say that it is associated with four type of anions. And these anion data specify the Z2 topological order. Yeah, so for the Z2 topological orders, you have one, the vacuum particle, which is nothing. And you have E particle, you have M particle, and then you have EM particle, which is basically a fermion. Yeah. The reason being that if you have a composite E particle, M particle here in some location in the space, if you also have a E, M particle here in the location in the space, then they behave like a fermion. And this is a statement you can try to prove or understand, or you can ask me later. Yeah. And relatedly, there's some kind of fusion rule that's associated with fermions. Associated with these anions. So this is the fusion rule, which describes what happens when you put these anion together. How does it behave? So when you put this E particle together, it fuses to vacuum because you can align it to E particle, right? And similarly, you have N cross M to be one, and you have F cross F to be one, and you have E cross M to be F, because when you put E particle and M particle together in some location in the space, you behave like a fermion. Yeah, so these are the so-called fusion rule, which describe when you put some anion together, whether they behave like a different anion or not. Yeah. So, yeah, this concludes the first lecture. So basically, there's a notion about the anion excitations. Those are the topological particle, and there are some interesting gradient structure that cannot happen for either fermion or boson. Yeah, and so this can be seen from a concrete lattice model, which is very nice. Yeah, so this concludes the first lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Very nice. So since we started a bit late, we're running also a bit late, but if there is one question, just this.
Just one small question, more detail. So the perturbed Tori code, can we estimate like exact precisely what is the value of the critical G, or just that it's order one?
Oh, right. So in general, you're required to do some Monte Carlo simulation to pinpoint the location of the critical point. And in some cases, when you perturb Tori code in some particular perturbation, that can be mapped to some dual 2D Ising model. And there we know people have more control about how to simulate how to find a critical point using a numerical simulation. Yeah. Yeah. But so in general, there's no good way to understand where is the critical point. Yeah.
Another one? Okay, let's thanks Peter again. And